This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Radio is everywhere.
Always accurate and precise.
Bloomberg's really one of the places that's reporting facts.
Your communication capabilities are wonderful for our business.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. On this weekend edition of Bloomberg Best,
investors grapple with prospects for more rate hikes.
You really shouldn't trade this like a bear market. You shouldn't expect the wheels to fall off the cart. You shouldn't be afraid to trade this market. Don't expect things to just collapse.
Credit may deserve more credit, according to some.
It's a very exciting time in the credit markets with the volatility we've seen in equity and credit.
And how Macy's bags it while many other retailers struggle.
In 2022, we ended the year with 3% less inventory than 21, but 18% less inventory than we had in 19. We were doing virtually the same level of business.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the week, powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
Ed, we'll hear this coming week from Fed Chair Jay Powell for sure. He, of course, is heading up to Capitol Hill to testify before Congress.
Yeah, we'll also be getting the jobs report coming this Friday, Denise.
Yeah, and Minneapolis Fed President Neel Kashkari, well, he said he's open-minded about the size of the Fed's next rate hike later this month, but it's actually something else he's watching right now.
We raised rates very aggressively last year once we concluded that our models understanding the inflation were not working because of these dynamics are so unique. We realized we just had to get aggressive and catch up so we were not falling further behind. So we raised rates 475 basis point moves in a row, then downshifted to 50, then downshifted to 25. And so there's a lot of attention to the next meeting in March. Is it going to be 25 or is it going to be 50? I'm open-minded at this point about whether it's 25 or 50 basis points. To me, what's much more important than whether it's 25 or 50 is what we signal in what's called the dot plot. So every 3 months, every participant in the FOMC writes down on a piece of paper a projection of what we think optimal monetary policy looks like. And because markets are forward-looking, this signal about where we think rates are headed actually contains a lot of really important information. So in December, when I jotted down my dots, I jotted down that I thought we would get rates up to 5.4% and then hold them there for an extended period of time. And I was on the more hawkish distribution amongst my colleagues. I was not the most, but I was on the more hawkish side. Given what the data that we've gotten in the last month, which has been a very strong jobs report, higher inflation than we expected, I mean, these are concerning data points suggesting that we're not making progress as quickly as we would like. At the same time, we shouldn't overreact to 1 month's data, even if the data is troubling. So to me, whether 25 or 50 is less important than what the dots look like. And at this point, I have not decided what my dot is going to look like, but I lean towards continuing to raise further, that I would continue to push up my policy path. We've got another inflation reading yet to come. We have another job report yet to come before the meeting. Ultimately, that will inform me. But I think the bottom line is, I think where the dots end up is going to be much more important than whether we raised by 25 or 50 at the next meeting.
Minneapolis Fed President Neel Kashkari speaking there in a question and answer session in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
But at Chris Harvey, he's head of equity strategy over at Wells Fargo Securities. He says, don't be afraid of investing in stocks. He says the bear market is over.
Harvey also says he thinks the Fed will hike a bit more and then wait.
You really shouldn't trade this like a bear market. You shouldn't expect the wheels to fall off the cart. You shouldn't be afraid to trade this market. Don't expect things to just collapse. That's not true. The underlying fundamentals are good enough. The credit markets are strong enough. And if you find good risk rewards, that's where you want to place your emphasis. But this is not the great bull market, the beginning of the great bull market. What this is finding really good risk rewards. Some of that is on the front end of the rate curve. Some of that is in mid-cap growth, and some of that is overseas.
And we just heard Harvey mention credit, Ed.
Right, Denise. A whole parade of people telling us that going forward, private equity or private credit is compelling.
Including Tony Tutrone, global head of NB Alternatives at Neuberger Berman. But he also kind of indicates proceed with caution or at least be discerning.
Obviously, offices are under tremendous, office buildings are under tremendous pressure right now. So within the real estate market, I do think you're going to see bigger challenges than you're going to see on the corporate side, especially in areas like office buildings, which I think the recovery there, if it happens, is not going to be so robust.
So not going to be so robust, huh? That's one way of putting it.
Well, meantime, Ed Oaktree is setting up a new fund aimed at the private lending market.
So Armand Panossian, Oaktree's head of performing credit and also CEO of Oaktree Specialty Lending, tells Bloomberg's Jonathan Farrow why he thinks now could be a good time for this.
It's a very exciting time in the credit markets with the volatility we've seen in equity and credit, as well as the banks stepping away from the private credit markets. We believe that it's the most attractive time that we've seen in several years in private credit to originate first lien loans to private equity sponsors doing new deals at very low loan to values and very attractive returns. And Oaktree, just given the fact that we've been in private credit for actually 20 years, not so much as heavily in the large cap sponsor lending market, but we have the capabilities to really lean in heavy right now, and the benefit of not having any legacy portfolio issues that would shackle us. So we're moving in with a lot of conviction right now with a very large fundraise.
I mean, that last point I think is really important. What are the advantages of not having those legacy policy issues, as you pointed out, legacy portfolio issues?
Unfortunately, over the last several years, there was some excessive lending practices, both in broadly syndicated or tradable loans, as well as in direct lending. That was reflected in tighter pricing than what we're seeing in the market today, a loosening of covenants, and fairly high loan to values in newly originated debt. Today, on all three of those metrics, it's more lender friendly. We're seeing spreads on newly originated loans 100 to 150 basis points wider just over the last 12 months. We're seeing base rates, SOFR, the standard overnight rate, up from roughly 1% a year ago to now over 4%. And then in terms of loan to values on new deals, routinely we would see 60 or 65% loan to values on new leverage buyout transactions a year ago. And today it's more like 40 to 50% with better legal protections as well in the form of covenants.
So I was just thinking, are you saying that this is getting more attractive for a lender at a time when traditional lenders are actually pulling back?
Yes, it is. The traditional lenders have legacy portfolios that are higher in loan to value, lower in price versus what is the current market. And I think there's some cracks in the economy that are showing up in portfolios that are giving them reason to pause, which is creating the opportunity for a large new entrant that is able to navigate through landmines.
Can you give us an idea of the average coupon size? And I know this is difficult because you guys have got bottom up across a range of industries, different places, but can you give me an idea of what's on offer here at the moment?
First lien private credit is being priced at about SOFR plus 6.5%, which lands at about a 12 to 12.5% coupon rate on those loans.
Looking at what's happening in traditional fixed income at the moment, with a 2-year at 4.90 and a 6-month T-bill at 5%, how competitive do you think this actually is historically?
I think it's better than what it has been historically. And I think the relevant comparison is if you look at the best 80% of the tradable credit market in below investment grade, and you compare it against newly originated private credit in today's market conditions, you're picking up about 300 to 400 basis points of spread or return in going to the private markets. So that's really the relevant comparison, and we find it to be attractive, incredibly attractive relative to the last 5 to 8 years.
And a lot of the time on this program, we spend a lot of time doing macro top-down stuff. I know for you guys, traditionally, it's all bottom-up, it's quite micro. Within industries at the moment, are you seeing lots of dispersion, lots of opportunities away from the macro stuff?
Within industries, yes. There are certain industries that benefit from inflation. There's some opportunities there. There are other industries that there are leading positions or leading companies that are able to defend their EBITDA margins or their cash flow margins, even through volatile economic and market conditions. And when there is volatility driven by market technicals, that creates an investment opportunity for fundamental investors like Oaktree.
Can we talk about landmines? Sometimes in this business, as you know, it's not what you choose to own, it's what you choose not to own. What are you avoiding?
We're avoiding sectors and businesses that have very tight cash flow margins, companies that are not able to pass through cost increases to their customers without demand destruction. Obviously, traditional retail is problematic given that backdrop. Certain types of real estate are seeing cracks as well, especially in the office space. But we're more focused from a bottoms-up perspective on the quality of earnings and the quality of businesses' capabilities to weather through downturns by very active cash flow management.
Do you see the risk of a situation where some of these landmines blow up and cause issues in places where they shouldn't, that people have to sell their stronger hands to cover their weaker ones? Do you see a situation like that potentially developing?
It's possible, but you know, that type of risk was more apparent during the global financial crisis when there were vehicles that did not have matched assets to their liabilities. They had short-term liabilities with long-term assets, and it caused them to sell their best positions to really shore up their liquidity. That's not really the case right now. There really isn't mismatched assets and liabilities. So investors should be able to weather the storm and hold on to their best assets if they don't have meaningful outflows that they need to supply liquidity for.
And that was Armen Panossian, Oaktree's head of performing credit and also Oaktree Specialty Lending CEO. And he was there with Bloomberg's Jonathan Farrow.
And coming up,
why Macy's is bagging better results than many other retailers.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Denise, Macy's is known for its parades, but it did not join the parade of retailers with weak earnings this time around.
Yeah, it really knocked it out of the park, according to some. And Chuck Grom is senior retail analyst at Gordon Haskett. And he tells Bloomberg's Tom Keene that Macy's, well, it's just doing a better job at managing things.
Well, right now, it comes down to inventory management at Macy's. And that's really what's setting the company apart from its peers, whether it be Kohl's or Macy's. Inventories were down 3% to end the year. They're expecting that trend to continue.
Yeah.
So as long as Macy's can continue to manage their inventory effectively, we think they can hold margins up.
They can hold margins up. But if you look across the pantheon of American retail, and granted, there's problem children like Kohl's, and maybe you put Nordstrom's in there. I'll let you decide who's good, who's average, who's better. They just have historic low margins. How do they maintain that given this environment?
Well, like I said, it really comes down to inventory management. It comes down to managing your sales within your store effectively. Historically, the operating margin profile of the business has been low. That's probably not going to change. You're looking at a low double-digit EBITDA profile for Macy's. Not tremendously different than in the past, but we're excited about how they exited the year from a top-line perspective. And the guide for 23 looks appropriate from a top-line perspective. They're forecasting comps down 2 to 4%. That looks realistic. I think the surprise is the EPS guide for the year, which is better than I think people were anticipating. And when you unpack the line items that they're giving us, it's really on the gross margin line, which again comes back to the fact that their inventory levels are clean.
Chuck Grom, senior retail analyst at Gordon Haskett, with Bloomberg's Tom Keene.
Well, diversification is certainly helping Macy's. It's higher-end Bloomingdale's and Blue Mercury outperformed.
And Jeff Gannett, CEO at Macy's, tells Bloomberg's Caroline Hyde he expects current trends will continue and luxury consumers could be the sweet spot.
Yeah, what we're seeing is that really all income levels are basically at a different level than they were in the beginning of 21. And so we expect that to persist. But certainly the luxury consumer is more resilient. And I think this is going to be a share game when you look at, you know, that it's a crowded playing field when you look at luxury. And it's going to be really incumbent upon retail to have the right product, the right value, the right experience, you know. And I think our Bloomingdale's and our Blue Mercury teams are doing an outstanding job. They had record performance in 2022. And I think that they are well poised to do very well with this luxury consumer.
Is that because the luxury consumer can look through inflationary pressure? How much can you pass on costs at the moment to the end purchaser?
Well, let's just talk about when we think about inflation right now. So what I would say is that when you look at across our portfolio of three brands, you're going to have modest ticket price increases in 23 versus more aggressive ones in 22. So that's starting to abate a little bit. And so I think this consumer is, they've got lots of choices. And so I think one of the things that is I'm looking to see where our competitors are with their inventory is we control our inventory well. And I think when you get the environment that is at status with demand, everybody benefits from that. What I'm very proud of is the fact that when you look at our inventory situation, we have the opportunity to chase consumer demand. And we're doing that with slightly higher ticket increases. We're using our pricing science. We're going after demand, be it in casual or be it in career, be it in travel, and to really respond to where the customer is going. And we're doing a good job of doing that in real time. So that we're looking at having open to buy reserves. So each of the merchants basically have the ability to respond to customer demand, and they're chasing after that demand and using our pricing science to get the most out of those transactions.
Dig into that pricing science. Dig into what has made you able to be far more disciplined and execute far more efficiently when it comes to inventory.
Yeah, let me tell you, take you back to the pandemic. So in the pandemic, we made a big, big shift in the way that we do our business with our vendors. We basically went from a model that basically had markdown allowances built into the receipts to a net cost model. So basically, we were reducing the upfront costs that we were basing goods on. The second thing that we did is we went from a functional incentive program where a buyer would get paid based on the performance of their category to one that was enterprise-wide. So everybody benefited from where the consumer went. So those markdowns and those receipts then became available for where the enterprise needed it to go based on consumer signals. Because the second you set a plan in retail is the second it begins to be wrong. The consumer's always voting and you always need to make adjustments. So what we did through 22 and what we really have in play for 23 is buying very conservatively and having open to buy reserve that we then use against how we play with receipts, markdowns, and reserves to customer signals. That's helped us with inventory freshness. So in 2022, we ended the year with 3% less inventory than 21, but 18% less inventory than we had in 19, when we were doing virtually the same level of business. So that gives us a huge opportunity to respond to in-season signals from the customer, chase trends, pull back from trends that aren't working as well as we had originally planned. And that's making a big difference in our relevancy for customers that have so many choices.
Talk to us about the choices and indeed how the competitive landscape looks, because as you said, a lot of it's to do with what they're doing, how their discounts are. Do you think that's going to pull back a little bit? Is everyone going to be able to look more at profitability for 2023?
I think you're seeing that now. I think you're starting to see, like a lot of our competitors, you know, that we do business against and with, is their inventory is much more in line with consumer demand. So that's a heartening thing for all of us when you see that customers are not having to respond to this glut of inventory that's out there, where the only way to move it is by lowering the price. You know, so I think everybody is getting demand and supply more in status. You know, we're seeing that, and I think all of our competitors are in a similar boat with that. So that's good news. That's good news. And I think the consumer is going to be able to respond to us giving receipts that are more in keeping with what they're looking for. And so, yeah, and you're not stuck with excess product that you haven't liquidated yet.
Talking about product, one of the innovations you've had is the marketplace to do with Macy's. You're expanding that. You're looking at the luxury buyer with Bloomingdale's for this. Just explain what this offering provides and how you're leaning into the digital side.
So obviously, when you look at customers, we have many categories that we service them in. And through marketplace, many more are coming. So in the fourth quarter, we launched the Macy's marketplace. We did this in September. We've added 20 new categories and 500 new brands as a result of marketplace. And that gives customers a lot more choices. Example, so during the fourth quarter, two of the hottest categories for us in marketplace that we really didn't have in our owned inventory from before was video games and electronics. Those are where customers, they trust Macy's as a brand. And so they're ready to transact with us if we have the right content for them. So much of our business starts on digital or is transacted on digital. So to have marketplace, that a customer, they don't know whether or not it's marketplace or vendor direct or owned inventory. They just know that when they come to Macy's, they can get a broad range of categories at great values. So that's what we're so encouraged by. We're going to be adding 2,000 new brands in 23 on the Macy's side, and we're going to be adding a Bloomingdale's marketplace in the back half of 23. So it just gives us a lot of flexibility. Because we're a trusted brand, we're a department store that has many categories and about to have a lot more as a result of marketplace.
So lastly, fill out a quick survey for me. If you had two options, you're optimistic or more pessimistic, which one would you be ticking?
I'm balanced. You know, I have a lot of confidence in our team. I have a lot of confidence in what we're controlling. I think that the outlook that we're looking at right now is we're assuming it continues the way that it is. But, you know, I'm not an economist. So we're always looking at the signals, the macro signals and the micro signals. What I know is that our team is poised and we're ready because of our financial, you know, health and what we're doing with our operational efficiency and our great desire to serve our customers in the best possible way across all three of our banners to do that in as good a way as we can. So we're very motivated to be there for our customers.
And that was Jeff Gennett, CEO at Macy's, with Bloomberg's Caroline Hyde.
And coming up,
more turbulence in the banking industry, but there are also some bright spots.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York.
Bloomberg 1130.
To Washington, D.C.
Bloomberg 991.
To Boston.
Bloomberg 1061.
To San Francisco.
Bloomberg 960.
To the country.
Sirius XM Channel 119.
And around the globe.
The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com.
This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. Ed, we had a fresh round of job cuts, unfortunately, at Citigroup start to come down this week.
And Bloomberg Sally Bakewell, Denise, says the entire industry is feeling the pressure.
So we're talking about hundreds of jobs across the company, with many from the Wall Street Giants investment banking division. Now, this is another indication, really, that the expense pressures that banks are facing, they're really leaving no one immune. The size of job cuts across Wall Street, they varied very widely. Citigroup already eliminated dozens of staffers across its banking investment banking division in November. And then we had Morgan Stanley trimming a far larger number of employees, about 1,600 in December. And then along came Goldman Sachs, which embarked on one of its biggest rounds of reductions ever in January, cutting about 3,200 positions. But it all indicates that they are all susceptible to these pressures, and they're trying to pull that lever of headcount reductions to meet that.
Bakewell also says the cutbacks are coming after many banks stopped routine cuts during the pandemic.
Also, they're facing a deal slump, and investment banking units are suffering from that as well.
And Denise, Goldman Sachs President and COO John Waldron is talking up Goldman's strategic realignment and opportunities. Here's what he told Bloomberg's Sonali Basak this week as Goldman unveiled its 2023 Investor Day in New York.
I think if there's a 2.0, it's really talking about having two market-leading businesses: global banking and markets, and asset and wealth management, which are businesses we've been in for a very long period of time, now run together in an integrated fashion. Global banking and markets, a $30-plus billion revenue business, generated 16.4% returns last year, definitively outperforming our competition. We've done a great job in those businesses, and now when you see them together, you see the power of those franchises, and you see some of the diversity effects of those franchises, where in some cases, market headwinds for certain of the franchises that are tailwinds for others, and vice versa. And you can see those businesses really performing across cycles in a mid-teens returns kind of manner.
When you think about asset and wealth, I'm really curious about how much you're willing to invest. Well, is this something you think you'd do a large transformative deal around in order to gain scale?
Well, let's just talk about the organic opportunity in asset and wealth management. And today, again, in global banking and markets, Dan Dees walked through the story. It's a very, very compelling story. In asset and wealth management, my partner Mark Nachman walked through that story. And to your question about a 2.0 version, we're now running asset and wealth management as an integrated platform where we have scale in active asset management. We're a top five player in active asset management, and we're a top five player in global alternatives. I'm not aware of another platform that has our kind of scale in both. That's pretty unique. And then we have a premier wealth management franchise with $1 trillion of assets on that platform.
We have to also talk about kind of this years-long journey in consumer as well. You've said you're considering strategic alternatives. How much detail can you give us around what those strategic alternatives are? Could it mean the sale of all or parts of the business?
Well, before I address your consumer question, and I will address it, just in asset and wealth management, this is a very important, again, back to your 2.0 question, this is a very important growth opportunity for the firm. With the scale I talked about, we now have significant fundraising objectives in front of us. We have a significant management fee target in front of us. We now have $8.8 billion of management fees in that business against a $10 billion 2024 target. We're clearly well on our way to hitting that target, and that target is not the limit of our ambitions. $2 billion of that $10 billion target would be from alternatives. We're now at $1.8 billion on that $2 billion target. So in both cases, total and alternatives, we are well on our way to hitting and exceeding those targets, which will make the firm more durable, more resilient, and more valuable. And so that 2.0 version of asset and wealth management is going to be a significant growth vector for the firm going forward, where you have two market-leading businesses, both mid-teens returning businesses, both durable, both resilient through the cycle, both where we are market leaders, which really underpin the financial targets we put out with our investors.
So that's the future, but as you get there, there's still this idea that it'll take 2 years for the consumer business or the platform solutions business to break even. Do you think investors will be patient with you along that journey?
Well, you asked about consumer. Okay, so we talked to our investors very much about our path to profitability. We basically said we would do three things in the firm. One, we would grow wallet share and grow our financing businesses further than we already have grown them, and we've grown them considerably. Two, we will grow our management fees. And three, we will create profitability in platform solutions. We will deliver profitability in that segment. That segment has transaction banking, which is a profitable business, and it has consumer platforms, where obviously we have had losses. In those consumer platforms, we have a plan to drive to profitability. We told our investors today we would drive to profitability in 2025. We likewise said that we will look at and explore and are exploring strategic alternatives to make sure that we understand all opportunities in front of us to unlock value in platform solutions across those consumer businesses.
And that was John Waldron, President and COO at Goldman Sachs, with Bloomberg's Shanali Basak.
Now, things appear to be going swimmingly at Santander.
Yeah, Banco Santander Chairman and Executive Director Anna Botin tells Bloomberg's Francine Lacqua she thinks they can really keep it up, as a matter of fact.
It's a new phase of value creation for shareholders. For the first time, we're announcing and committing to double-digit TNAV and dividend per share growth. We also announced a 50% payout from 40 and another buyback. So, yes, it's a new beginning for a very exciting period for Santander.
And this is, amongst a lot of your rival, a lot of banks actually in Europe trying to do the same. Do you think we're in a new phase for dividend policy overall?
Well, I think European banks are going to do much better. I think Santander is going to do better than others. So the double-digit TNAV and dividend per share should put us ahead at the top end of European banks' profitability and growth for the next few years, but also value creation.
I mean, there's a lot of banknotes at the moment saying that actually probably their forecast will have to rise with it. Is that a sign of success?
Well, you know, what's really important, success is delivering on what you commit. And we delivered on the 2019 Investor Day plans in spite of COVID, the war in Ukraine, now inflation. And this is really important. And so that gives us a huge confidence that the model works, mm-hmm. that our customer focus in market and global scale and diversification actually are providing good returns for shareholders. And this is an acceleration of that delivery. And this is really what matters.
And how much of this is thanks to rising interest rates because of the European Central Bank and the global economy? And how much of this is delivery on strategy?
That's a great question. We said it today, more than half is actually because we are improving every year and we're going to do much more in the next few years, improving our operating model. And some of it is, of course, tailwinds. You know, it's not healthy to have an economy with negative interest rates. If you're a saver and you get nothing, and European banks did not charge you, and we're a retail commercial bank, so we suffered more than most. And we're giving mortgages out at 10 basis points. That was a year ago. And so, yes, some of it is tailwinds, yes, but it's a normalization of interest rates. It's a normalization of how the system should work. And more than half is what we are actually delivering in terms of a better operating model.
When actually will you start charging for deposits?
So, you know, what really works in our economy is competition. So we are in very competitive markets and we're adjusting to each market. In Spain, for example, Open Bank, who has grown 350,000 customers last year, our digital bank, is already paying for deposits. So it will depend a lot on each market situation.
So what's next in terms of where that will change? I mean, do you look at it region by region or actually country by country?
No, country by country.
And is there a target country? Like, when do you think that you'll be able to charge on deposits almost throughout all of your operations?
So you know, it depends. I mean, in Brazil, for example, interest rates have been at 12% already for 12 months. You know, Mexico is 8-9%. So it depends very much on each market, how fast the change is going to happen. But at the end, what matters, again, is that we're in competitive markets. We have been, you know, really misallocating capital because, you know, capital was free. And so that is no longer the case. So, you know, again, to me, it's a normalization of of the macro of the interest rates.
And are you comfortable and confident that you'll be able to keep the cost of risk under control?
Well, we have already guided for this year. We should be below 1.2. Our through the cycle cost of risk has been around 1%. And at the end, risk is about the whole balance sheet. We have a very strong model in terms of liquidity. We should outperform peers because we're a retail commercial bank and we have local liquidity. 85%, 80% of our deposit base across the group is retail, not market funded. So that is a very important part of the overall profile. And yes, we are expecting credit risk to go up slightly, in some cases normalization. But for this year, we've set below 1.2.
Anna Botin, Chair and Executive Director at Banco Santander, with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix.
And coming up, Ed, AI and a superhuman agent for auto racing gamers.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Denise, some new technology has just been introduced into the auto racing or motorsports space, as some say, for gamers.
That's right, Ed. Sony's Gran Turismo is adding GT Sophie. That's a powerful artificial intelligence agent that you can compete against as a player.
And Sony's AI COO, Michael Spranger, tells Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow and Caroline Hyde, we could all be riding the slipstream of this one for a long time.
This month, we release it into the game in varying levels of difficulty. So if you're a beginner, if you're intermediate, or if you're an expert, you can drive against the agent. But we balance the performance of the car, so you do have a chance against the agent in beginner mode. But you can also race against it, 1v1, full head, you know, same cars against a fully blown superhuman racing agent that we released last year. And so we hope this really can inspire people to learn from the agent. And it's an important step for the game because, right, you know, if you are an expert in the game, it will take some time for you. And you need friends actually at the same level to compete against. And that's what the agent actually addresses.
Mika, a few weeks ago, we had Sonia Huang, who's a partner at VC firm Sequoia, on the show. And she has this thesis that by 2030, generative AI tools will be so good that they will be used to just dream up video games. And I wondered, what big picture work is Sony doing to that effect in the video game space?
So obviously, I mean, gaming has always been technology driven, right? And so we are looking at new technologies. Obviously, there's been a lot of buzz around ChatGPT, Midjourney, and these kinds of models. For us, it's really important that this technology is there for the creator. So we are interested in what this does to gaming creators, how it helps them create fulfill their creative visions. And so, you know, people are starting to take up the technology. I think there's a lot of things that still need to happen in the technology as well for this to be really useful for gaming. But we do see also, you know, people already starting using it, the artists are using it. And that's really important for us because for us, really, the creator, so we are a creator-centric company, is really about what the creators are doing with this technology.
What more needs to be done to the technology to make it really purposeful, really useful for Sony?
What we see today is a lot around 2D image generation, but you know, games are 3D. I mean, that's just a very big one. And obviously that's something that would need to be addressed for this to be really impactful on the gaming production pipeline. But again, you know, I think the technology develops extremely fast. GT Sophie was a Nature paper last year. It's in the game now. So, you know, the cycles from like high-level technology breakthroughs to actually bringing this to users or creators around the world is very, very fast. One thing I would say, though, is what is really important for us is really the ethical aspects of this, right? So we need to make sure also that this technology is developed in a responsible way. Yes. From the data that goes into it, it needs to be fair and transparent. You know, people have rights, creators have rights. These need to be respected. It's also important what happens on the output side. And so for us, actually, AI ethics is at the core. For Sony AI, we have this, we have a dedicated team looking at all the projects we're doing from an AI ethics perspective and really shaping how we develop the technology.
Do you need to be hand in hand with governments around this? Do you need governments to work alongside to build this ethical roadmap?
I think it's important for governments to play a role, but I think this is also beyond governments. From a Sony perspective, we have a responsibility for our creators. We have, you know, we work with them on a day-to-day basis, you know, in many ways they're part of the company, actually. And for us, it's not just about government regulation. For us, it's really about making this technology for the creators so that they can unleash their creativity and their imagination. And so the human for us is really central. Right. And yeah, of course, governments, you know, play a role in this, but it's also companies that have to step up.
How can we know how competent Sony AI is at its craft? What makes you different? What makes you stand out from all those other AI players out there?
We have extremely high impact projects, and we aim also for, you know, technology contributions that really are recognized. For instance, the GT Sophie agent was featured on the cover of Nature, and that's really an important part of us to raise awareness about the technology, but also show that we are actually able to do that. The other thing is really, as part of Sony, as I mentioned, for us it's important that we focus on the people and how people use this technology going forward to, you know, fulfill their creative visions. And I think that kind of sets us apart. And, you know, our voice, I think, should be heard in this space.
And that was Michael Spranger, AI COO at Sony, with Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow and Caroline Hyde.
And that's it for this edition of Bloomberg Best. I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
And stay with us. Top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.